Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today, I'm interviewing Captain Charles Moore, who is the first to cross upon an enormous stretch of floating plastic debris now called the Pacific Garbage Patch. The patch, also described as the Pacific Trash Vortex, is an area in the North Central Pacific where tiny bits of trash, together weighing as much as 100 million tons, have been trapped by the currents of the North Pacific Gyre. Captain Charles Moore founded in 1994 the Algalita Marine Research Foundation. In 1995, he launched his Loch Crowther-designed aluminium-hulled research vessel in Hobart, Tasmania. Since then, he's logged over 100,000 miles of research voyages. He helped develop protocols with Southern Californian Coastal Water Research Project for monitoring marine and beach plastic pollution. He's the author of several scientific papers on plastic particulate pollution published in scientific journals and is a world-renowned investigator in this field. His voyages to the eastern garbage patch of the North Pacific Gyre have been featured in magazines such as US News and World Report, Natural History, Best Life and Discovery. He's also been on CBS evening programs with Dan Rather, The Osgood File, Good Morning America, Nightline, and in October 2007 editions of NPR's All Things Considered. International media outlets in Europe, Asia, Australia and South America continue to request interviews with Captain Moore on the topic of plastic pollution of the world ocean. So welcome to the program, Captain Moore.
Very pleased to be with you today, Helen.
Yes. So let's first have you describe how you came upon this tremendous plastic island, if you will, or patch in the North Pacific Ocean. What actually happened, and what did you first observe?
Well, actually, my vessel, having been designed and built in Australia, had to be delivered back to the mainland of the United States, where my home port is. So during that delivery voyage, we were dismasted and couldn't get another spar in Australia, so we had to be freighted from American Samoa to San Diego and then installed a new rig for our sailing research catamaran. And in order to test that, we had entered a Trans-Pacific Yacht Race, the longest race in the world from Los Angeles to Honolulu, 2,500 miles. Now, the strategy of all the sailors in that race is to absolutely avoid this North Pacific gyre because high pressure systems and near their center are very devoid of wind. And this is a sail race, so you want to stay way out beyond the edge of this thing. Well, on the way back, the race is only one way. It's from L.A. to Honolulu. On the way back, you have to go way north to go around this thing. And then about the latitude of Washington or Canada, you can turn east and go toward the mainland. And in order to avoid having to make that high reach around the gyre, being a research vessel and having extra fuel, we decided to take a shortcut through the gyre. And basically, not for any other reason than to save time and not go out of our way. And this was 1997, which happened to be the largest El Nino on record in the North Pacific. And that high was extremely large that year and extremely calm. And so for a full week, we basically had to motor sail. We never got more than 10 knots of wind. And that light wind condition allowed whatever neutrally buoyant plastics were floating around out there to come up and bob around on the surface. So for a full week, it wasn't as if I saw a mat of trash, but every time I came on deck, something was floating by. And this sort of set off alarm bells, because I was as far from civilization as you can get anywhere on Earth, and yet I couldn't come on deck without seeing some man-made object or a piece of some man-made object floating by.
Okay, so what we need to know what the definition of a gyre is, how it's formed, and how large this North Pacific gyre is.
Well, there are two kinds of gyres, one caused by low-pressure systems and the other caused by high-pressure systems. But basically, the concept is that of a maelstrom, or for those who don't know that term, a toilet bowl effect, in which there's a circular current with a central phenomenon. Now, in low-pressure gyres, stuff is higher in the middle and spit out around the edges. So they're considered distributors of the debris. They push it away from the center. And the high-pressure systems, it's like a mountain of air over the center, and that depresses down and actually makes a lower sea level at the center. And so that circular current tends to accumulate and bring things into the middle, and has a true kind of a toilet bowl effect. So sweeping the Pacific Rim is a high-pressure system that is bringing our trash into this central area, and that stable system is known as the North Pacific Subtropical Gyre.
And how large is this gyre?
Well, if you look at it in terms of its overall size, from the very edges near Japan to the edges near California, and then down below Hawaii and up to around 40 degrees north latitude, it's about the size of Africa, about 10 million square miles.
Good Lord.
Now, the question is, how polluted is it? Well, it hasn't been fully sampled, but everywhere we've looked in there, we found alarming amounts of plastic. So my feeling is that nowhere, because based on our research, nowhere is free from this pollution. The question is, well, are we going to call 10,000 pieces per square kilometer bad, or is it only a million pieces per square kilometer that we're going to call, you know, heavily polluted? The question, you know, begs an answer if you want to have that kind of calculus. But for me, I'm afraid what we've got to say is that the whole ocean now has a new constituent in it, and that is plastic.
And did sometimes when you looked from your ship, did you see just masses of plastic, or as you initially described, just bits floating by quite frequently?
In 2002, we saw the first actual string of debris that could be considered a solid line. It wasn't a mat, it was a line. What we find is that the ocean creates these striations, these lines of debris. You often see them in the nearshore area as white foam coming out. And in the deep ocean, in this area where there's calm, and so you're not getting a lot of breaking waves, you're not getting a lot of foam, but you do get these upwelling of counter-rotating currents, and that leaves a line of debris on the surface. And we found it stretching for miles. We could never find the end of it. And it had Japanese traffic cones and little tiny chips of plastic and coat hangers and rope and, you know, we find these ghost nets that are big balls of rope, and we never could figure why there were so many different fisheries represented in one ball of net when, you know, fishermen would not have that many different types of net. And then we realized the ocean was knitting in these rows, bringing everything together and knitting it together. The ocean is always knitting, and that was our theory why we were getting these big balls of such diverse types of net.
Okay, so you've kind of described what stuff is there. So how did it get there? Who's chucking this stuff into the ocean?
Well, I don't believe people are standing on the coast with their garbage and chucking it into the ocean. What I believe is happening is that we're simply overflowing with cheap plastic waste, and it's just not all making it to a landfill or to incinerator. The ocean is downhill from everywhere, and things blow and wash into the ocean when it rains. And it's just a little bit here and a little bit there. But when you're talking, say, for instance, here in Los Angeles Basin, 20 million people living by two rivers that get infrequent rains, when we get a heavy rain, that stuff that's been littered on the street, whether it's cigarette butts or plastic chip bags or whatever it is, that's getting blown and washed down into the sea. And we found 2.3 billion pieces in just 3 days of sampling our two main rivers weighing 60 tons, just random stuff coming down the rivers to the sea. So we think about, we kind of go along with the UN figure of 80% land-based and 20% from ships at sea. But when you get out in these gyres, you're seeing mostly fishing gear because as you get farther from shore, the influence of the identifiable objects from civilization is less, and the floats and nets from the fishing industry is more.
And so I've known for years that many ships, including cruisers and passenger liners and
Navy ships
and, you know, what are the ships that carry the container ships. Yes. They just chuck their rubbish, don't they, overboard? I mean, hasn't that been par for the course?
Legal until the 1980s.
Right.
And then the International Maritime Organization, which is the branch of the UN that handles areas of the commons of the ocean,
yeah,
created a MARPOL treaty, a marine pollution treaty, and Annex 5 deals with pollution from ships, and that treaty prohibited throwing plastic overboard anywhere at sea. It allowed wood and glass and food scraps to still be thrown over, and coming up for revision this year, and we're hoping that they eliminate that too. But since 1984, signatories to the MARPOL Convention have been enjoined from throwing this over, but that's only your bigger ships, and of course, navies seek exceptions to that. For instance, a submarine can't surface and take their stuff back, so they actually have a dedicated torpedo tube for jettisoning their bags of trash.
Do they really? Huh.
Yeah.
That's
come under scrutiny, and you know, they're promising to do something about it, but still, to a large degree, there is no enforcement of MARPOL, and so it's possible for any ship to get away with jettisoning their trash. There are efforts being made to, just as in the case of oil tankers, keep logs of the amount of oil they have, the amount of oil they use, and the amount of oil they discharge, so that a Coast Guard person can measure what they come in with versus what they should have and see if they've lost something. So we're trying to get this kind of record keeping on ships so that we can monitor their trash and make sure that they're using portside facilities to discharge it.
So, Captain Moore, how many ships are at sea at any one time in the world?
Well, the number is increasing rapidly. They're the semi-trucks now of world civilization. They're the carriers of the goods made in Sri Lanka that are intended for Australia or Los Angeles are coming by ship, and the shipyards have at least 3 years of orders ahead of them. Every shipyard is fully booked. The amount of traffic on sea is starting to reach the kind of, if you look at the lines on a map, it's starting to look like those lines you see in the airline pocket magazine that shows the routes of the airlines. It's just a solid mass of lines all over the earth. Things are being transported everywhere by ship, so we really need to be aware of the fact that that's the new route of globalization is shipboard transport, and the consequences of that aren't fully known.
Can you give me an estimate of the numbers of ships at sea?
Well, I can give you is an estimate of the number of containers that fall overboard every year from ships, which is up to 10,000, and they don't even have to be reported. And it's a deal with the insurance company where they can report they had a loss and try to get their insurance money, but no Coast Guard agency, no UN agency is keeping track of it. On one of our voyages, we found a container spill of plastic bags intended for Taco Bell and the Baby Superstore and Sears and Roebuck that stretched for 10 miles, and all these bags made in Asia heading for the United States had spilled off a container, and we could never find out what ship spilled them, or no one is responsible for the cleanup.
How do they get off the ships? I mean, are they not attached securely?
The ocean is an extremely powerful force, even for a ship that's, you know, 300 meters long. There's still an extreme wave tilting of the ship, and when that ship is hit broadside by a big wave, no matter how firmly those containers are lashed, and they're sometimes, you know, 10 high, that force of that wave hitting that is absolutely tremendous. And many times you'll see just a load has shifted, and just some of them will be lost. Sometimes they're punctured outright, but the routes that these ships take are great circle routes and often lead them into storms. And because of the rapid turnover of goods and the desire to get things to market quickly, they are not stopping because of any storms. They're motoring right through them, and they get in trouble quite often.
Yes, I read somewhere where there was a container containing Nike shoes, thousands and thousands of them, and then the shoes all washed up on a beach on an island, and everyone
Well, you have to be a little more... you have to look into that a little deeper. What actually happened was the ocean separates things right and left. So the right shoes went one way and the left shoes went another. So a whole beachcomber network had to be created so that they could get pairs of shoes. It's even believed that the reason we have right-handed and left-handed people is because our ancestors in the ocean were more successful if they created a right and left-hand version of
themselves. You're joking, aren't you?
Ocean would come and distribute it more effectively.
Aren't you joking about that?
No, that's true.
I don't understand how the left-handed shoes went off on in one direction.
Well, you know about the sailing vessels being on the port tack or the starboard tack. A right shoe might take the starboard tack and a left shoe the port tack. So they diverge in the direction that they would float.
And what
Part
about...
Part of them is sticking up above the water.
Yeah, right. Incidentally, I'm interviewing Captain Charles Moore, who's a surfer and a scientific researcher and a sea captain, and was the first person to come upon the stretch of floating plastic debris now called the Pacific Garbage Patch. What about... the carbon footprint of transporting all these containers hither and yon on the sea to various countries continuously, what's that doing to the global warming situation?
Well, I think looking at the economic system as a whole and the fact that labor is such a big part of manufacturing cost, and there's just no stopping a manufacturer from seeking out the cheapest labor anywhere it may exist on Earth. And if he can find a new labor force in a new country at a few dollars less per day, he can move his entire factory very quickly. And the transportation cost is based on petroleum resources being readily available. So the carbon footprint of the product that you're getting is virtually unknown because you don't know where it was made and how it was shipped and what transportation was involved in getting that to you. But I'll tell you, every product, no matter whether it's a piece of metal cookware or some clothing, is going to be wrapped in plastic. It's going to have packaging that has a single use and is never going to get used again, and that packaging is ending up in the ocean.
Yeah, I grew up, you know, I'm now 70, so when I was a child there was absolutely no plastic, and in my lifetime, as you say, the transition from glass, metal, paper and rubber to plastic has happened insidiously, silently and cryptogenically. Would you like to talk about that a little, Captain Moore?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd first like to say that our generation, I'm in my 60s, is the last one that will have ever swum in an ocean free from plastic. We are the last ones to have experienced the ocean without a plastic load. The ocean is seriously polluted now with plastic and will be for the foreseeable future. So that, to me, is a sad fact of life now, that no subsequent generation will experience an ocean that's not strewn with plastic fragments, even down to the nanoparticle size. But having now entered the plastic age and have plastic being ubiquitous and part of the food delivery system, part of the product delivery system, part of the transportation system, part of the building of our homes. Plastic is everywhere, and yet that fact, the fact that we live in a plastic age, is not heavily publicized. It's much more important in the growth economy to get products to market than to understand what those products are doing to us and to our environment. And so we push and push and push for the new, the next best thing, the exciting new invention, the neat new package, the cute new product. But those fancy products are made from plastics that have extremely different and, in some cases, very bad consequences. They're loaded with chemicals in order to make them flexible. They have phthalates added to them in order to make them hard, like in the polycarbonate sports bottles, the Nalgene bottles. They have bisphenol A added to them in order to, for instance, in infant care facilities, in order to give these premature infants all their nutrients and stuff, they're giving them through plastic tubing and plastic bags. Those have been found to change the sexual characteristics of male infants through the endocrine disruptors that are transmitted by the plastic. So they're not inert. We've somehow gotten the idea that plastic is inert and doesn't need to be studied on its own as a pollutant, but there's no evidence that it's inert. It's releasing chemicals at every stage, and not only does it release the chemicals used in this manufacture, when it hits the environment, it immediately starts to soak up oily contaminants. So anything from petroleum, anything pesticide, herbicide that has an oily character, even if you have an oil spill, those booms you see around vessels fueling up are made out of plastic. Plastic is lipophilic. It loves oil. So it's a sponge for pollutants, and it releases. It's a sink as well. And these factors are perhaps so serious that they're leading to epidemics. Dr. Vamsal believes that the liner of the tin can, no matter whether it's organic peas or whatever you're buying, baby food or whatever it is, that thin coating of epoxy on the inside of the can that makes it smooth contains bisphenol A, and that is known to disrupt insulin metabolism, and he believes it's responsible for the epidemic of diabetes and obesity in the developed world.
Well, I read recently that bisphenol A, was developed as an endocrine stimulator. It has estrogenic-like properties.
Yes, it was going to be used after World War II as an estrogen for women, but diethylstilbestrol, DES, was found to be more powerful, and so it kicked out bisphenol A. Which then ended up in plastics. But the DES was found to be a latent carcinogen and was taken off the market. But if you treat a mouse in the laboratory with DES, which is very similar to bisphenol A, and give them both the same diet and exercise, you'll find that one mouse grows to twice the size of the other one, even with the same diet and exercise, because of the way it puts on fat after being exposed to these chemicals.
Well, I don't understand why, if they develop bisphenol A as an estrogen mimicker for use in medicine, how on earth did it get transferred for use in producing plastics? I don't understand that.
In products such as plastic and even in our foods, the philosophy among regulators is innocent until proven guilty. You don't have to do a lot of precautionary testing in products for market. Only drugs have to go through precautionary testing. Foods and other products simply have to be put out there. And
toxic chemicals.
It's up to the public or individual scientists to prove that there's a problem with them. So the philosophy of product introduction needs a serious revision based on 86,000 man-made chemicals that didn't exist before the 1950s, and the fact that our body burden of those chemicals now ranges in the 100 to 200 range. In other words, if you take some serum from you or your grandchild to a laboratory and have it analyzed, you'll find that it contains about 150 chemicals unknown to science before 1950, and many of those will be those endocrine disruptors. So We've got a big challenge ahead of us trying to rid ourselves of the contaminants of civilization, and that job is not being undertaken by the status quo. It's just too daunting for the growth economy.
Well, forget the growth economy for a minute and talk. I'm talking now as a physician, a pediatrician. It seems to me that because those 86,000 chemicals in common use every day, very few of them are tested for carcinogenicity, mutagenicity, or toxicity.
Or endocrine disruption.
I mean, you know the paper that they wrap fish in now, it feels nice because the inside surface is very smooth, and that is coated with plastic, I think, with either phthalates or bisphenol A in it. And bags you buy your coffee in, you know, they're all smooth inside. Almost everything we come upon in life, and as you pointed out, everything is wrapped. I mean, they said in one of the main major food outlets, I can't remember the name of it now, they're in Los Angeles, the apples that they have are wrapped twice in plastic, twice.
Yeah, no, that's not uncommon now.
But I don't know how we're going to do something about this, Captain Moore, because the whole of industry now is dependent upon plastic. I mean, I'm sitting at my desk here. I've got a wooden table. I've got a computer made of plastic and various rare minerals. I've got a printer made of plastic. We've got all our equipment is actually housed in plastic. My telephone is plastic. The carpet on my floor is synthetic. The heater in my room is plastic. I mean, everywhere you look.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get any university dedicating a department to understanding the consequences of that. I think it would require a new kind of institution, which stood in contrast to the academics of today who are principally involved in bolstering the economy. These questions are not good news for the economic system. They require slowdown. They require rethinking. Many of my colleagues, like Brown Garden and McDonough that wrote Cradle to Cradle, believe everything has to be redesigned. But we don't have redesigned universities. We have universities looking at nanoparticles. We have universities working on military hardware. But we don't have universities looking at problems from products. And that's what it's going to take.
Yes, well, I've been acutely aware of toxicity and pollution, I guess, all my life, and particularly from a medical perspective. But I think I'm only just waking up now to the ubiquitousness, if you will, of plastic and how it totally, I mean, we're saturated with it. Almost everything we use, everything we buy is wrapped or made of plastic. And then, of course, you said 20% of that ends up in the oceans. And so,
well, 20% of it, we don't know the fraction, but it may even be more than that, because when you analyze figures of plastic that goes to the landfill versus plastic that gets recycled, you get about 45% with an unknown disposition. And so we don't know how much is really ending up in the ocean or maybe scattered about land. But I know scientists are saying that future geologists, should there be any left over after we've ruined the planet, will find a plasticine layer.
Yeah.
Any core sample that you want to take will have microscopic particles of plastic, if not larger objects.
Yes, and the one thing I meant to ask you too about ships at sea are the fishing ships, which, you know, the industrial fishing ships that have nets that are 100 kilometres long, for instance, and then those nets get discarded into the ocean. I mean, the irresponsibility of fishermen on the whole is vast, is it not?
Yeah, we're hoping to get some kind of record-keeping as part of the MARPOL Treaty. A study done in Canada found that 10% of all static fishing gear, like, say, for instance, crab traps, is lost, and that results in the decimation of 10% of the target population. So you can you know, kind of extrapolate that. If 10% of the fishing gear is lost and it's killing 10% of the population, and you're doing that on a regular basis, you know, you're doing a lot of what's called ghost fishing, where no one profits from the catch. You're just simply destroying it, and that's going on ocean-wide.
We're such an irresponsible species, aren't we?
Well, it's not so much that we haven't got the capacity to be responsible, it's that we're driven by the need to survive in an economy which is geared towards competition. You know, we could have a steady state economy. We've got the resources.
Mm.
You know, Braungart talks about the ants. You know, the biomass of ants is greater than that of humans, and no one says there's too many ants on Earth because they're living in a steady state economy. You know, they're supplying and resupplying their basis for their existence on a regular basis. The same thing happens in the forest. No one goes out and fertilizes the trees, but the forest sustains itself for millennia.
Yeah.
So we could have that kind of economy in our industry. We just have to seek out ways to do it. We have the technological advancement. No one wants to get rid of science. We simply want to use science in the service of sustainability.
Mm. I'm interviewing Captain Charles Moore, a scientific researcher and sea captain who is the first to come upon the patch of plastic debris now known as the Pacific Garbage Patch, and that's what we're talking about. Now, I'd like to move now to the persistence of plastic waste and how it's a growing constituent of ocean water per se, and how it's causing increased harm to the creatures of the ocean.
Yeah, that's very important to understand that this extremely fast growth of plastic, I mean, even nations that have no petroleum industry, the feedstock of plastic, for instance, India has 15,000 processors of plastics employing 500,000 people, and they don't even have petroleum. They have to import everything.
Well, what is a processor of plastic?
The way it works is the two main plastics we see are the bottle and the bottle cap. The bottle is polyethylene, and that is what would be coating your coffee cup or making most of your bottles and soap bottles and shampoo bottles and so on. And then the cap is polypropylene. Now, those are made from ethylene gas and propylene gas. These can be made from natural gas. They can also be synthesized from the oil barrel. We say about 10% of the oil barrel or 10% of the petroleum resources go into making plastic. And this material, as a monomer, as a single molecule, is not plastic. It becomes plastic when it's catalyzed into a long chain of molecules, a polymer.
Mm-hmm.
And those polymers then have different characteristics than the monomer. That's why Dr. Ebbesmeyer says that an oil spill on a scale of 1 to 10 might be a 2 in the ocean, but a spill of plastics would be a 9, because the oil spill is principally monomers that can be gobbled up after a decade or two by naturally occurring bacteria and other organisms. But plastic polymers, being several hundreds, maybe thousands of molecules long, there's no organism on Earth that can simply consume that size of a molecule. It becomes what we call bioinert. And as a bioinert substance, it's not degradable. It can break into fragments, but the molecules themselves don't disappear. So it would go down to the nanoparticle size, and as I mentioned, it's a sponge for pollutants and carries some of its own from the factory. So here we are creating products going into the ocean that are breaking and breaking and breaking down, but not going away until they become individual molecules of plastic and delivering whatever poisons and drugs they may have inside of them to the food web in the ocean. This is an experiment being conducted with no controls and no monitoring, and I think it's a very serious issue. We've seen 100,000 marine mammals die in the North Pacific every year just from getting tangled up in this stuff, but now we're finding that the fish are eating it. We sampled 671 fish from the central gyre and found 1,391 pieces of plastic in those fish. One little 2.5-inch long fish had 84 pieces of plastic in its tiny stomach. So we're concerned that this pollutant is now being mistaken for food. The food is scarce in the ocean, and anything that looks like food is going to get gobbled up, and that's what's happening.
Yes, and as you point out, that the stomachs of the fish get packed with plastic particles that look like food, and then they can't eat because the stomach is full of plastic, and then they die of starvation, or the plastic goes down into their gut and causes intestinal obstruction, and they die of intestinal obstruction. Yeah. And
that's not just happening with fish, it's happening with birds, it's happening with cetaceans, it's happening
with turtles. The birds, of course, the seabirds, the albatrosses and the other birds
take
these little fish and mash them up and feed them to their babies. And so the baby albatrosses just hatched from their eggs are imbibing bits of plastic, which kills them.
Yeah, we've seen over 100,000 dead every year on Midway Island with their bellies full of plastic.
100,000 dead what?
Laysan albatross, and black-footed albatross.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, no, they're eating plastic even directly. They're scavengers of the ocean. So, true, they're eating fish and squid, but they're also eating bottle caps and cigarette lighters and pipes and toothbrushes and combs and little toy wheels and little toy soldiers. These are all things commonly found in the stomach of four-month-old albatross chicks that don't make it.
Oh, God. It's a wonder any of them are making it now.
Well, that's just it. We're afraid there'll be a crash of some species before anything's done.
Now, there are little tiny nodules of plastic that are used in industry to be melted down to turn into bottles. What are they called? There's a name.
Well, they're plastic resin beads, and the junior lifeguards here in Southern California nicknamed them nurdles. They found
nurdles.
Them as they were waiting to take their exams sifting through the sand.
Yeah.
They're distributed by rail, and vacuum hoses are attached to the rail cars, and when that connection is made and broken, many thousands of them spill out onto the ground, and then when it rains, they wash down into the sea, so that even in a remote area of the Hawaiian Islands that has no plastic factories, 10% of the plastic pieces on the beaches are those little pellets.
What size are the pellets?
They're about 3 millimeters in diameter. They come in cylindrical shapes, spherical shapes.
Are they clear plastic or what color?
A recycled plastic typically will be black because it's all different colors mixed together. Virgin polyethylene is usually translucent, kind of clear. Same with virgin polypropylene and virgin polystyrene. Virgin polystyrene is heavier than water, so it would sink and be found mostly near shore, but the polyethylene and polypropylene pellets float out in the ocean, and we find quite a few of them out there.
Nurdles.
Now, they've been shown to absorb up to 1 million times the level of pollutants that are in the ambient seawater. Dr. Takata over in University of Tokyo did experiments and found they were very, very good at absorbing plastic contaminants to their plastic matrix so that they become transport mechanisms. They concentrate the pollutants and then transplant. They look just like fish eggs. And so they're eaten by many species of birds and fish.
And they concentrate things like dioxins and PCBs and that sort of thing.
That's correct. DDE, the metabolite of DDT, the legacy pollutants, and even the petroleum aromatic hydrocarbons, the PAHs, the benzene ring, those things will be concentrated.
Which are
most of
them are carcinogenic.
Yeah, that's a very serious concern.
Then what about the plastic bottles, the polyethylene, polypropylene, breaking down themselves in the seawater to form tiny, tiny little particles?
That's a big, big issue. Most of the stuff we find is in the less than 5 millimeter size class.
Mm.
And the thing about the PET bottles, the polyethylene terephthalate, that's your common water bottle, is that it will sink. And it's only going to float if it's got the cap on it. So as soon as that cap starts to crack in the sunlight, it photodegrades, it cross-links, and the UV rays of the sun make it brittle. When that cap then cracks, that bottle will fill with water and sink. Well, that may have drifted 1,000 miles before that happened. So it's likely that the sea floor is contaminated with our water bottles, since we use like 5 million of them a minute right here in the United States.
Oh, my
God. I mean, we use a tremendous amount of them. And many of them don't make it to recycling centers and end up in the ocean. And those bottles will then drift if they've got the cap on them until the cap breaks, and then they'll litter the bottom. So same thing with the polystyrene styrofoam clamshells that you get your food in. Those things only float until the little air pockets break, then they'll sink too. So polystyrene, another very common consumer plastic, and the polyethylene terephthalate are likely to litter the seafloor worldwide.
But what about them breaking into little tiny pieces as they degrade?
Well, we think that the polyethylene that floats, which is most of the other polyethylene besides the terephthalate one, and the polypropylene, are becoming embrittled in sunlight, even if they're fouled by organisms like algae and diatoms because of the yo-yo effect. What happens is, you'll get bryozoans and diatoms and algae growing on these particles of plastic, and then they'll start to sink down
little
out of
organisms,
the,
yeah.
The photic zone. These organisms will be heavier than water, and the thing will sink. But as it gets below the photic zone, the zone where light penetrates, they stop growing because they're all based on photosynthesis. So as you then digest them through the bacterial action at those deep depths, you remove the coating on the plastic that was making it heavier than water, and then it can float back to the surface. So we think that that's why we're getting so many tiny particles. It's the yo-yo effect. They wouldn't maybe at a certain size sink to the bottom, except they're being floated back to the surface after the stuff digested off of them. We find, you know, and the tiny particles, only 10% or so have fouling organisms on them. So they're like constantly being flipped over and getting exposed to the sun, and it's just a situation in which it becomes very, very brittle. The hydrolytic properties of seawater and the cross-linking properties of the UV rays are such that it takes very little energy to break them after they've been embrittled out in the ocean.
Now, the polyethylene bottles that people, 5 million people per day, get their water from, they've got, haven't they got phthalates in them? Do they leach phthalates into the water?
It is polyethylene terephthalate, and I'm not quite sure how mobile the phthalate is in that, but what we're mostly concerned about in those is antimony, a heavy metal. That is not a good thing to be ingesting a lot of, and that's what you're getting, one of the major contaminants in your typical, you know, case of bottled water is antimony.
So what does antimony do in the body?
That I have to leave to you, my dear, as a physiologist.
I don't know that. But I do know that phthalates and bisphenol A actually accumulate in those plastic bottles, particularly when they've got Coke in them, which is quite corrosive. And one of the reasons, apparently, we think that young girls, particularly young African-American girls, are having very early menarche, growing breasts and having periods when they're 5 and 6, is because they drink so much of this liquid in these plastic bottles.
And eating a lot of canned food, yeah.
Yeah, eating a lot of canned food. Now, I'm interviewing Captain Charles Moore, who's a scientist, as you can hear, and who's a sailor, and who first discovered this dreadful Pacific garbage patch in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I've got an article here where it says, you said your research found 6 to 1 plastic to plankton, and plankton is the sort of the basis of the food chain in the ocean, 6 to 1 plastic to plankton by weight in 1999.
Yeah, that was out in the gyre, and then we later found about 2 to 1 near coastal areas around Los Angeles.
And then you went back last year and found 46 to 1 plastic to plankton.
Yeah, if you take the average of all of each sample, you know, take the ratio of each sample and add those ratios up and then take the average, it was 46 to 1. So it is growing. These areas are what we call depauperate, they're oceanic deserts. And so it's true that there's not a lot of plankton there, but that just makes it that much harder for the things that do live there to distinguish. They're being bombarded. It's as if you went into the market and had perfectly painted apples made out of plastic stuck into the display,
yeah,
and one out of 6 or 1 out of 40 apples was actually a real apple. How good would you be at filling your basket with just the real apples? You know, you'd probably pick up a few plastic ones. That's what's happening out there. These fish are being fooled.
Are you getting much publicity, Captain Moore, about this? Are you able to get on the media and educate people about this? And also, what effect is your campaign having politically and in the scientific world?
I have to say that because this particular issue doesn't carry a lot of partisan baggage, we are getting good exposure, and the state of California, the Lieutenant Governor's office, has created a flotilla of legislation, including a leash law to make the bottle caps stick to the bottles, a nurdle bill to make it illegal to discharge these pellets into the ocean, a extended producer responsibility bill and green chemistry bills to make manufacturers more responsible for their products. So here in the state of California, we do get good legislative initiatives. And as far as publicity goes, I just returned from the Netherlands. The Netherlands is very concerned about this. The author there wrote a book called Plastic Soup about this issue. And we were on National Geographic Channel there on Earth Day and got a lot of good press. I just had an interview with a Swiss reporter yesterday. So I think the word's getting out around the world that this is a serious problem. I'd like to get more. Japan is aware, but I'd like to see more from Asia and Korea. And we've had some inquiries from Korean reporters. But, you know, Asia's coming on as a huge producer of this material and a consumer of it. And it's a big discharger through their rivers into the sea. So we definitely need to get India and China and Korea and Indonesia to realize these consequences. The problem is, historically, trash degraded. Most indigenous cultures made baskets out of reeds and banana leaves and, you know, taro and tea leaves. And these things could be thrown at the side of the road, and you, next time you come by, they're already gone. But that lifestyle proliferates still in the age of plastic, and we haven't done a good job telling the world what plastic means. Plastic means forever.
It feels
you can't expect it to go away like the other stuff did.
No, it's like nuclear waste. It's forever.
Yeah.
You can't get rid of the bloody stuff, to use an Australian expression.
Well, I know you've done a good job educating the world about that fact, and I'm trying to live up to your high standard and educate the world about the persistence of plastic.
Well, I'd like to help you. I've actually just revised my book, If You Love This Planet, that I wrote in 92, about all sorts of things, toxic pollution, deforestation, desertification, nuclear power plants, overpopulation, species extinction. But in the revision, and the book's coming out, I think, in August or September, I've enlarged very much the section on plastic. But, you know, there are so many problems confronting us at the moment as a result of the misapplication of science. And I have to lay the responsibility for this absolute mess, just the one we're talking about now, at the feet of the scientists who got all involved in making more and more polymers out of oil and natural gas and very excited. And then how those discoveries were used by industry.
You can't stop human creativity, but it must be in the service of humanity.
Yeah.
And we just don't have that anymore. The humanities have been excised from the university system. And now all research, whether it's in humanities or not, is directed at a commercial goal. And somehow we've got to recreate a university system in which humanity and its needs become the goal of science and thought. We've simply got to start, as one person said, observing Obama when they said, you know, how does he handle the race card? He says, Obama's not about that. He's about ideas and thinking. And we really need to become more about ideas and thinking and not so much about production and consumption.
Yeah, I think that I can't stand the thought that universities, which were once pure sort of centres of rational thinking have turned themselves into commercial centres. And, of course, they're funded to a degree, large degree, by corporations and by rich people who want to push their own barrows to make more money. And I think we've seen the end result of capitalism now about what's happened to the whole system in America. It just reaches a sort of tipping point where the whole thing collapses like a house of cards.
Yeah, but then they, rather than use that as an impetus to reassess the system as a whole, they're stumbling over themselves to prop it up and bring it back to where it was. That's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah, I think Einstein said that. The other thing to point out too, I think, Captain Moore, is not just humanity, because our survival, very survival, depends upon the web of life and the ecosphere. And unless we attend to that, we're doomed.
Well, we're in charge now. And we have no excuse.
Mm.
We can manage the world and its resources rationally, or we can continue to do it irrationally. That's the choice.
Well, look, I think Obama's quite magnificent, and he is a great thinker and I think a brilliant diplomat in many ways. He's good into sociology, but I'm not sure how much he knows about science, and I'm sure he'd be open to learning about this, but the point is, how do we get to him apart from creating a massive grassroots movement, which, as I know, is difficult?
I think what we've got to do is get a nation, and I've proposed that start with, and you might propose it in Australia, but I'm proposing that the Netherlands be the first to insist that the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, is headquartered in Kenya, in Africa, take on this issue, the plastic soup, the microplastics. Here in the United States, our government has relegated the issue to derelict fishing gear, and they're looking to have drone aircraft find the derelict fishing gear and try to fish it out of the ocean. But this whole idea of a plastic soup and the ocean having a new component is not being addressed, and in order to get that to happen, some nation has to insist that the United Nations Environmental Program take it on, and that's the stage we're at right now. We've got to have pressure from the nations of the world to monitor this. Every coastal nation that has access to the ocean, in fact, any nation that has a large lake, should be assessing the plastic load in that body of water.
Well, and it's like nuclear waste, you know. If you've got a problem that cannot be solved, and this can't be solved, then you have to stop making the stuff. And
that's right. You're absolutely right. You've got to stop putting it in.
Yeah, we've got to get to the bottom line. We can't have everything wrapped in plastic. It's absolutely ridiculous and actually, from my perspective, obscene. Well, look, we've run out of time, Captain Charles Moore. It's been an absolutely fascinating show today, and I thank you so much, A, for the work you're doing, B, for the pioneering work that you've done, and C, anything we can do to help, please let us know. And if people want to find out more, they can go to your webpage at
algalita.org.
That's right. Do that again. algalita.org.
Correct.
Mm. And thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm honored.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for listening this week. I think that each show that we do illustrates more and more how we must, each of us, take personal responsibility in our lives, both for our children and for the planet. And I think it's imperative that we all learn and understand what science has been doing to our planet, really behind our backs and creeping up insidiously and invidiously without our actually realizing what the side effects have been and will be. I really welcome you to listen to If You Love This Planet, and it's a very important exercise to become scientifically literate in this present day and age. For if we are not, I think that the hope for survival gets to be more dismal. Today we interviewed Captain Charles Moore, a fascinating man who actually is a sea captain as well as a scientist and a researcher. He actually started off being a surfer, and it was he who discovered the Pacific garbage patch, or the plastic trash vortex in the middle of the North Central Pacific, where tiny bits of trash, together weighing as much as 100 million tons, have been trapped by the currents of the North Pacific gyre. In talking to Captain Moore, it's become clear that the pollution of our oceans, epitomised by the patch's toxic stew of plastic particles, is actually a land-based problem. Captain Moore says what drives the market and what runs off the street into our oceans are part of the same problem. I'm Helen Caldicott. Thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet, and we'll be back to you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.